May it please the court, counsel, I'm Jersey Green representing the appellant. I think my time is best spent by figuring out what the court wants to know. First, are there any questions as to whether we are dealing with a property interest in the Kaufman Family Trust as versus a mere expectancy? Are there any?
Counsel, you've requested argument today. I assume you had something you wanted to tell us.
Yes.
So why don't we get into that?
All right. Well, this is a property interest. It is a property interest because it is a future interest that's already fixed. It's vested. It's not subject to any type of defeasance or divestiture. Secondly, it is the wife's separate property. It was gifted to her. There's no dispute about that between the parties. There is no dispute between the parties that the interest that she has in the Kaufman Family Trust appreciated during the marriage, and it appreciated in a very significant way. It appreciated over $500,000. The difficulty that we have is that the court did not recognize that appreciation and value as something that it was required to divide under the statute. And under the statute I'm referring to, Title 14, Chapter 10, Section 113, Subsection 1. The court is required to make a determination as to whether the thing is property, and secondly, whether it is subject to division. And so if you look at the way the case was resolved, the court concluded that, well, you know, this item is difficult to get at. We've got these, the trust and the deed of trust that has a non-alienation provision, also has a provision that keeps the trust from being revoked or amended. The reality of the situation is, and I've cited the statute or the points in the record, the trust itself expired in August of 2003. It expired by its terms because the grantors failed to renew the trust prior to the date of expiration.
How can we rule on that issue without affecting the rights of other beneficiaries of the trust? How can we get into that?
Well, you could resolve that issue by allowing their interest to remain unfettered. When we're dealing with a trust, there's often other beneficiaries of the trust. The court is in no position to order that anyone dispose of or encumber their own separate property. And so the mechanism by which the court, whether it's at the appellate level or at the trial level, to fashion some method by which the appreciated value is to be divided is not something that's unfamiliar.
Does that not force a sale of that property?
Not necessarily. In reality, what happens, let's say if we had a clean situation that here's the trust, the property or the appreciated value, as in this case, is tied up in the trust that the wife can't get to that trust, even if it wasn't in a trust, let's say there was a piece of land, but it was her separate property and we didn't even have a trust involved.
Well, let's stick with the trust, if you would.
Okay. If we stick with the trust, we know that whether it's a trust or not a trust, the court cannot say, you go out and encumber that property, or you go out and you sell your separate property. We know that the court can't order anything like that.
Right.
But what the court can do and should have done is to determine, well, from this over $500,000 of appreciated value, there's some portion of that that should be equitably divided. And we're not talking about a division that mandates that the spouse go and sell or encumber the property, but it's very common that whatever that separate property interest is, that's the way the spouse who owns the separate property ends up coming up with the money to do it. Sometimes it's
well. How do you do that when it's a fractional interest like this?
Well, no different. I mean, we're not talking about a mechanism by which we are forcing anything to happen with the trust. For example, the court could simply say, all right, we've got a $500,000 interest. If we determine the husband's equitable share of that is half, the court could simply order that the wife execute a promissory note for that share. Whether it's secured or unsecured, that's how you do it. You don't have to worry about how do we get the money. That's really the husband's problem. It's how he actually collects on the promissory note.
Do we have a choice of law issue here in the respect that under the law of Illinois, the appreciated value of the separate property would still continue to be separate property as opposed to the Colorado law?
No, we don't.
Why not?
Well, one, my client is not a party to that agreement. The parties who were participants in that agreement are the ones who chose Illinois law. This action was filed in Colorado, specifying that the case is to be decided under our statutory scheme and our decisional law. If we had a prenup, for example, perhaps there'd be a prenup that would say, well, any disputes we have in the marriage are going to be decided by Illinois law. We don't have anything like that. My client was neither a signatory on the trust instrument, was not a signatory on the deed of trust, had nothing to do with it. The wife, neither party, Illinois doesn't have jurisdiction over either party in this case. Both are residents of Colorado and have been since 1988.
So Illinois law is irrelevant in this case, regardless of the language in the deed, which provides that Illinois would be the choice of law?
No, it's not irrelevant. Illinois law is relevant because we use the Illinois law, their tools of construction, to construe what the contract means. And those rules are not unfamiliar to us in Colorado. They're basically the same. And so when we see language in the Illinois trust that says the trust shall terminate unless such and such is done within a certain time, then the trust in fact terminates. And when we see in that, and that's true whether we're looking at Colorado law or Illinois law, and when we see in the trust instrument that says no amendments may be made and no modification may be made to the terms of this trust no matter what, it means exactly what it says.
So we look to Illinois law for the termination provision but not to the choice of law provision.
That's correct. Choice of law in turn, and I'm understanding you to mean choice of law in terms of whose statutory scheme we use to decide, right? Is there something there to be divided? That's exactly correct. And so if you look at the record, you'll see that the net value of the marital estate, when you look at the assets and you look at the liabilities, was only about $20,000. That was really the net value of the marital estate. And here we have got over $500,000 worth of appreciated value in separate property. Clearly, absolutely, no question about it, marital property subject to division, and the trial court fails to divide it. It needs to be divided. This is such a substantial part of the case that the error in the trial court failing to divide it is contaminating the issues of the rest of the property division, is contaminating the issues of the court's determinations on maintenance, and is contaminating the court's determinations on the attorney fees issue.
Is it your contention that it's essential that we determine whether the trust in fact was terminated to rule in your favor?
No, I think that that's not necessary. I spent a fair amount of time on the brief as to why it was terminated. And only because the trial court believed that the trust was still in existence, and so I felt that I needed to show that it wasn't in existence. The wife was subject to a temporary injunction not to take steps that ended up placing marital property out of the reach of the court. It's our contention that she violated the temporary order in that regard. That's not an issue that this court needs to decide, but if you look, for example, at Title 14, Chapter 10, Section 120, Subsection 1, you'll see that, and you compare that with Section 107, you'll see that temporary injunction is supposed to expire when final orders enter, but when you read the two statutes together, that's all subject to appeal. And so for this period of time and moving forward, the temporary injunction, our position is still in effect. And this is not without a plausible remedy. The trust, when it was extended, was only extended to December of 2014. And so we'll be back in front of the trial court if the if this court believes that we have a meritorious basis for a remand, that we'll be back in front of the trial court in time to have that issue addressed. And I think that we can get it straightened out in some fashion. Mechanics can be left to the trial court. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Sergey Thomas, registration number 20,002, appearing on behalf of the appellee in this matter, the wife of this dissolution action. In counsel's statement regarding this position on the property interest, and I think two things have to be reviewed in this situation. One is there are definitions for the interests of the grantors in this trust under the trust itself, and also under the law of the state of Illinois. And so in terms of looking at how we define the property interest, it's clear that when the trust indicates that the choice of law is the law of the state of Illinois, that has to be the source of those definitions. I think it's clear that in the law in the state of Illinois, that the increase in the property is still a separate property of the wife, that there is, and that definition is something that I think should carry into the analysis that the court entered into in this case, and I think properly found that because of the definition in the trust agreement itself, which specifically indicated that the property interest that the grantors had was only into the income that was produced by the trust. And looking at the deed of trust, which is in the name of the trustee, none of the grantors had any interest in terms of their interest as far as the deed in the property that constituted the corpus of the trust.
Why wouldn't the most significant relationship test apply here for choice of law?
Because I think when we have the property situated in a different state and the trust agreement, which again specifies the choice of law in terms of interpreting the trust, those definitions, I think, basically trump the significant relations test in terms of just how we look at what it was that was the intent of the settler of the trust and how we go about giving effect to what the intent of that trust was. And I think when the argument is made that it was simply to take the property and to define it under terms that may be relevant in Colorado when this trust was entered, I don't think that can be an argument that holds much credibility. I think it was clear that the intent was to, using the definitions in the state of Illinois, to make sure that that property was defined under the definitions contained in that state.
And do you have authority for that proposition?
In the case law, cited brief regarding the interpretation of the trust, I think that basically interpreting the language of the trust to give effect to what was intended in the trust, I think is the authority that allows that the court to look at it in terms of how the intent is manifested in how it defines the property interests. In terms of the issues of the other property division, I think again the abuse of discretion is the standard by which this court reviews those issues. As far as the issues in terms of interpretation of the trust, that's reviewed de novo. One of the things that I think the argument from the appellant is built upon is this notion that there had to have been some termination of this trust at some point in time, which in fact was not the case. In the brief, he cited the Mortimer case, an Illinois case that address this issue of the fact that if there's no provision which reserves the right to amend the trust, then it simply cannot be amended or altered. However, in that same case, there is a citation to another case which provides an exception to that, which states that when all of the beneficiaries agree to a modification of the trust and they're available to do it, sui juris, then the trust can be modified. And so essentially that's what happened in this case, was the grantors in this case agreed to make modifications to this trust, which was consistent with Illinois law, which is also consistent with the position that the attorney who drafted the trust agreement testified to during his deposition. And so, and given that, there was no issue about this trust ever having terminated previously. And so again, when the trust indicates what the property interests of the properties are, that never changed based on any claim of the trust having been terminated.
So setting aside the issue of termination for a moment, why isn't the marriage of Balancing case essentially dispositive here?
I think Balancing is not dispositive because Balancing, again, I think has to serve the purposes that are laid out in the trust. And when we're talking about property that's not situated in Colorado, where we don't have these parties who were anticipating, you know, having to, I'm sure there's no evidence to show that at the time that this trust was entered into that Colorado would be a venue where the issues of this trust would somehow have to be determined in the course of a dissolution of marriage action. And so Balancing, I don't think, takes into consideration the fact that the property is situated in the state of Illinois. It is defined under the laws of Illinois. And given that, I think that there must be some deference to the trust document when it indicates that is the choice of law.
Well, I guess what's concerning is, you know, here we have one asset that's in another state, but conceivably a married couple could have assets in a number of states. And it sounds like what you're saying is wherever the property is, wherever the asset is, we look to that law of that particular state to determine whether it's property and whether it's subject to division, even though it's a Colorado couple, lives in Colorado court, and otherwise Colorado statutes apply. I mean, that sounds like a mess.
It would be a mess, I think, had it not been for the fact that there was a provision that made a clear statement about the choice of law for interpretation of that trust. I think if it was silent in terms of whether the law of the state of Illinois would apply or not, then yes, then the laws of Colorado should then govern how we deal with that property if there's nothing in the trust document which directs us to a particular body of law. In terms of the argument regarding there being continuing issues regarding the other divisions of marital property, I think clearly the court appropriately made the determination in looking at the trust document and in looking at the other issues that affected the property division, including the finding that the husband had violated the automatic temporary injunction by cashing in proceeds from retirement funds without permission of the court or permission from the wife, that those funds should be brought back into the marital estate and divided. And the court did a calculation regarding that, and based on that calculation, took that into consideration in creating the property division order that it did. So there's clearly nothing that is in the record which would reflect that there was some abuse of discretion by the court, because the property that was going to be subject to division, the court carefully considered, reviewed, and even calculated what the net effect was, and based upon the assets that were available, you know, clearly gave the benefit in some respect to the husband by not requiring a child support payment, by you know, not having there be any other financial obligations which would simply require the wife to end up paying the husband, and only to have the husband reimburse the wife back certain funds. I think the other aspect of the court's decision that's important is that when the court was analyzing its ability to deal with this trust issue, I think it was properly construing the language in the trust so that when the anti-assignment provisions of the trust made it clear that it couldn't be assigned and it couldn't be encumbered in any fashion, in order to do what has been suggested by appellant's counsel, there would have to be some speculation about what the property would be, how it would be divided, given that the trust was still in existence. We don't know when the termination of the trust would occur. And in order to come up with a number that would satisfy some reasonable division of that property, there has to be more than simply a number of what the property is valued at, because obviously the value means nothing unless there's actually a sale that goes along with it that actually determines what somebody's willing to pay for. That wasn't something that the court had in front of it. That wasn't something that I think the court could reasonably rely on because of the speculative nature of what this property would be sold for and what funds would be available to pay any amount that the court could simply come up with in terms of what the division of that asset would have been. But again, I don't think that we even need to go there given the fact that this trust had specific terms that the court was required to interpret under the specific language in the trust document. I think it's very clear that the grantors had no interest given under the deed of trust to that land itself, but their interest was defined. And I think it was very clearly defined, and that interest of the Weiss was divided by the court equally. I think that was an appropriate division of that particular interest in the trust, and therefore would ask the court to uphold the trial court's ruling on the property division issues.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Green?
Thank you, Your Honor. Judge Kapelke, you're dead on. Balancing is square on this. Absolutely dispositive. I want to comment on counsel's concern that there might be some speculation as to the value of the trust or how what its value might be on a point of reckoning. That did not stop the balance in court. In that case, the parent had discretion to spend away portions of the estate. The court commented that, well, you resolve that by bringing in an actuary. You might have to make a present value determination and that sort of thing, but that doesn't stop the duty of the trial court to come to a reckoning as to what that value is and figure out some way of dividing. We don't have that complication here.
Mr. Green?
Yes, Your Honor.
Now, counsel contends that we must look to Illinois law to interpret the trust agreement, just to interpret the trust agreement, because it has a choice of law provision. And I think you've conceded that much.
Yes.
Okay. So what about Mr. Thomas's contention that the interest here under the trust document itself is limited to the income derived from the trust?
No, it's not. And it's not. That may be a component, that is income that is being received. In my opinion, that's not marital income because the property itself was a gift. I haven't resolved in my own mind whether the income coming off of that is still a gift that was offered up by the wife during the trial as a way of making the problem go away. My contention is that the most clear part of this is that the appreciated value is marital property. That's a big piece that wasn't.
But why is that so under the trust agreement itself? If we're looking at interpreting the trust agreement and what interest it conveys to the beneficiaries, what in the trust agreement says that an increase in value is the property of the beneficiaries?
Nothing. Nothing in the trust agreement says that. That's a function of Colorado law.
All right, but what about Illinois law? That would say something differently.
it would say something different, but it doesn't really matter. I mean, Judge Roman's comment and your question about why doesn't Colorado decisional law and statutory law apply, let me fashion it this way, explain it this way. Suppose that you have a party that is in the pre-dissolution of marriage frame of mind, and he decides, I'm going to take this property that I have, my separate property, and I'm going to move it to offshore investments. And those offshore investments don't allow for appreciation and value or even the corpus of that investment to be recognized as property. Why couldn't that be done? Would we still be questioning whether this jurisdiction can recognize that as property and can recognize the appreciation and value of that property as marital property subject to division? No. We're dealing with Colorado residents. They were Colorado residents at the time the trust was formed. Only one, namely the wife, was an executory on the trust instrument. She filed her divorce action here in Colorado against her Colorado husband and asked for Colorado law to apply. We don't need to go look at what other states may say about how they would divide up this property, because of course Colorado had jurisdiction over each of these parties. And whether it is simply because of a decision that you're going to file in Colorado and ask for Colorado law to apply, or you're going to apply the most significant relationship test, you still get back to, we have to apply our own law to protect the interests of our own citizens when we are deciding a divorce of their marriage here in Colorado. Any other questions?
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you to both of you for your arguments, and the case will stand submitted. We will issue an opinion in due course.